Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today we feature Professor Jonathan Rose, a professor of law and the Willard H. Pedrick Distinguished Research Scholar at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University, where he teaches contracts, English legal history, legal ethics, and antitrust. He has been a professor at ASU since 1968, go Sun Devils, and was associate dean from 1987 to 1990. Professor Rose served on numerous professional and governmental committees and as a consultant for various departments of the state of Arizona, including as a special assistant to Governor Bruce Babbitt and a member of the Governor's Regulatory Review Council and Arizona Board of Legal Specialization. He has written scholarly articles on a broad range of topics, including legal education, antitrust regulation, and healthcare reform in Arizona. He currently is interested in medieval English legal history and recently penned an article entitled Clergy and the Abuse of Legal Procedure in Medieval England. And that was in an edited collection of chapters called Studies in Canon Law and Common Law in honor of R. H. Helmholtz. It was that mention of clergy that caught my eye and earned him an invitation to our program. Jonathan, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much. I might add one thing. I'm now an emeritus professor. I retired. This is my fourth year of retirement, but I've continued to teach through last year and certainly work full-time on my research and scholarship. But I'm no longer an active teacher or full-time faculty member.
How is that going? Because I'm approaching emeritus status here in about a decade or so, and I'm kind of looking forward to that. Is it a really wonderful experience?
Well, it depends. I mean, we have lots of emeriti here, and they all seem to pursue their retirement in various ways. I would say I'm the only one so far, although there certainly may be others soon, who continues a full active research agenda as they did before they retired. Some people stop teaching altogether right away and just move on to other things.
Well, I am going to be looking forward to that, and it sounds like a pretty good deal. But in the meantime, we're here to talk about your article on clergy and the abuse of legal procedure in medieval England. And I always love historical topics on our show and have a fondness as well for medieval church history, which I know a little bit about, but I'm always eager to learn more. This really seems like an esoteric topic for a law professor. You know, I think most of us non-legal folks think that law professors just write about the most recent Supreme Court case or some zoning regulations that occurred somewhere in the United States. Whatever possessed you to delve into the world of medieval English law?
Well, that's a long story I won't tell you. I've actually written a law review article about it called Learning to Be a Legal Historian. But legal history has certainly always been a traditional field of research, scholarship, and teaching in law schools. Certainly in the United States, there are more people who study American legal history than English legal history. Medieval English legal history has always been popular, and there's certainly a number of people in history departments. I got interested in this because for many years I taught courses in the legal profession, and I had a sabbatical on a research project involving the legal profession in the United States and its regulation, and I decided I ought to learn more about the origins of the legal profession, and the two critical periods were medieval England, which is the origins of the Anglo-American legal profession, and colonial America, and I just got captured, you would say, and very enthusiastic about medieval English legal history more generally, and started writing articles about it and teaching it.
Yeah, this is one of the neat things about scholarship is that it leads you in a lot of different places. And I remember classes in colonial American history and college, and but going back as part of a research project oftentimes reinvigorates your love of the topic or helps you to rediscover the topic itself.
Yeah, well, this was really at the – I did this at when I was about 58. This was a major change in my primary scholarly emphasis from antitrust and economic regulation to medieval English legal history. There's no real connection, and it was a bit serendipitous, but I became interested and just sort of changed my scholarly focus. It involved a fair amount of learning, maybe fair amounts an understatement. All the records that you use when you do research in medieval English legal history are handwritten in medieval Latin or medieval French, or sometimes called Anglo-Norman or Law French. And so you have to acquire a substantial amount of language skills and paleographic skills, as well as just learning about the substance of the field. So that was a long, arduous learning process.
I can imagine that reading some of those documents, too, is difficult because they probably did not have the best penmanship back then.
Well, actually, their penmanship, I'll send you when we're done. You can look at what a record looks like. Their penmanship is quite remarkable. Certainly the court records, ease of reading records varies, but court records are among the easiest to read. The problem is many, many words are abbreviated, and the letter forms are quite different. For that reason, a lot of it's been put online, but they can't scan it. They have to photograph it because the scanning can't recognize the letters.
Yeah. No, that makes sense that the penmanship would be pretty good for legal documents. You want to make sure that you have clarity in communication, so you're going to pick the best handwriters out there.
Well, these were clerks who were literate in Latin, and this was their main job, to sit there in court and prepare the records of what was going on.
Well, let's start talking a little bit about this legal history, and I'm assuming that a number of my listeners are not very well steeped in legal theory, so some of the terms that we'll be using today are a little bit unfamiliar and probably need some definition. Now, you're looking at a period in history where we see the rise and development of something known as common law, and that term comes up a lot, and I'm often confused about what common law is compared to other types of law. Help us clarify, what is common law?
Well, in today's world, the word common law would mean judge-made law as opposed to statutory or regulatory law. But when it has a broader meaning, which is more relevant to the question you just asked, when we talk about the birth of the common law system. In the medieval period, the Western world was basically divided into what you might call the common law system and the civil law system, although you also have the church courts, which are much more closely related to the civil law system. So the common law system is the system that begins in England in the middle of the 12th century, in the reign of Henry II. As you imagine, not everyone agrees on that time period, but that's, I think, the majority opinion. and it involves the development of the institutions of the legal system which we would recognize today. Judges, courts, legal procedures, the legal profession. So when we talk about the common law in terms of the specific question you ask, we're talking about the origins of the common law as a legal system, which is very distinct to England, because none of the other countries of Europe followed this system, and then became the system that was used in those countries that were part of the British Empire, including the United States, Canada, Australia, and so forth.
And how does it differ than civil law? Now, was civil law being used across, you know, on the continent there in Gaul or France?
Civil law was and still is the legal system that is used all throughout Europe. It was a system that derived from Roman law and developed heavily in the Middle Ages in Germany, France, Italy, and but never in England. And it is quite different. It doesn't use juries. It uses an inquisitorial form of inquiry. It puts much more emphasis on codes and statutes. It relies much more heavily on the opinions of experts as to what the law is, and is not a system that is made that is based on judge-made law.
So what makes England unique in terms of common law originating there as compared to anywhere else?
Well, I suppose it's hard to know how that happened. I certainly don't know the answer of why Roman law, there's certainly a fair amount of scholarship about this, why England started on an entirely different path. Perhaps some of it derives out of England's own history under the Anglo-Saxons and the systems that preceded the birth of the common law in the 12th century, but it just proceeded on a very in a very different direction that was quite distinct and remains quite distinct from the rest of Europe. Certainly, there's no shortage in common law countries of statutes now, and you might say that once you get past formalities, there are certain aspects of the civil law systems and common law systems that at a practical level are somewhat similar. They have to deal with similar kinds of problems. Certainly a main distinction is the absence of the jury in civil law systems, although ironically in civil cases, England abolished the jury in the early 20th century, except for defamation cases and other cases involving injury to reputation. But the use of jurors and the development of judges who emerged out of the practicing legal profession were very distinct to England.
Now, there's another type of law that's floating out there during the medieval period time as well, relating specifically to the Christian Church, which is canon law. What is canon law?
Well, canon law is the law applied in the ecclesiastical courts, and it certainly throughout Europe you get an amalgam, ultimately, of canon law and civil law, that is applied in the secular courts. It's known as the jus commune. But the canon law, as opposed to civil law, derives from different basic texts. But essentially, canon law is the canon law applied in the church courts, and those that was the law applied in the church courts in England as well as the church courts in Europe.
And now I can imagine that canon law is going to conflict with common law at various points in time when common law starts developing. And I think that's the thing that we'll be discussing here in a moment. But what is interesting is that your article or your chapter appeared in a collection of essays called The Studies in Canon Law and Common Law in honor of H.R. Helmholtz. Who is H.R. Helmholtz and what's his legacy in this area of legal studies?
Well, Professor Richard Helmholtz, who has been now for some years at the University of Chicago Law School, is certainly one of the world's leading authorities, and perhaps the leading authority in the United States, on canon law. But there certainly was interaction or conflict between the canon law, between the ecclesiastical legal system and the common law legal system, so he certainly has a fair amount of expertise in the common law as well, but his volume in the ongoing new series called The Oxford History of the Laws of England, he wrote Volume 1, which is... I'll read you the exact title. It certainly would be regarded now as the authoritative work on the subject in terms of the canon law as it was applied in England. The title is it's Volume 1 of this series called The Oxford History of the Laws of England, The Canon Law and Ecclesiastical Jurisdiction, from 597 to the 1640s. If you would Google him or go to his webpage at the University of Chicago Law School, you would find he's written widely, numerous books and articles about canon law.
We will link to that on our website so listeners can visit that and explore this topic more if they are interested. Let's start exploring this topic because one of the interesting things we just mentioned was that canon law is going to start conflicting with common law as common law starts developing. What are the main points of conflict that actually occur in the 12th, 13th century?
Well, you have to understand conflict in various ways. The conflict that's most evident is a conflict over jurisdiction. Who has the power to decide certain types of legal cases? Certainly, doctrines may differ, but it's not so much, and they do differ, but it's not so, the conflict is not so much a conflict in different legal rules as it is a conflict in jurisdictional power. And, of course, the most famous aspect of that is the legendary dispute between Henry II and Thomas Becket, which has been the subject of much writing and as well as movies and books. You may be familiar with T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral and the famous movie with, I think it's Katharine Hepburn and maybe Thomas O'Toole, I don't remember, that's called, I can't remember what the, whether it's Lion in Winter, I always get a couple of these movies confused, but Thomas Becket who was a longtime associate and close to Henry II, the King of England, it becomes Archbishop of Canterbury and the Chancellor of England, which is the highest official of the state, a secular office, although filled for many years in the medieval period by bishops and archbishops. And there is an enormous fight over the jurisdiction to punish clerics who commit crimes. I don't know how familiar you are with this, but this is a, and as a result of it, Becket is murdered in Canterbury Cathedral, or at least allegedly as a result of it, in 1170. It is said that Henry II said, "Who will rid me of this meddlesome priest?" And Henry II's henchmen ran into the cathedral, and Becket was murdered. If you go to Canterbury Cathedral, you can actually see the spot where it happened. The king wanted jurisdiction over what he called the criminis clerks. Becket thought the church should have jurisdiction. A compromise was arranged that ultimately fell apart, and a system developed where, at least initially, the English secular courts had jurisdiction, but ultimately they lost that jurisdiction. Ultimately, Henry II lost this fight. But that is the certainly, and there's a lot of writing about this whole episode and this whole conflict between jurisdiction over the criminal activities of clerics. And out of it emerged a notion called benefit of clergy, whereby when clergy were charged with a crime, and certainly many of them were charged with the same crimes that non-clergy were charged with, they claimed benefit of clergy, meaning they were a cleric and wanted to be turned over to their ordinary, who was a representative of the bishop, who would come, and if they were confirmed as a cleric, this is also a large subject, and Dick Helmholtz actually has a very interesting article comparing the rules applied by the church courts and the secular courts to clergy in a book he wrote called The Jus Commune in England, but in any event, they were taken out of the secular system, turned over to the church for treatment and punishment, where they ordinarily underwent what was called canonical purgation, where they took an oath, and if they passed the oath, they were not guilty. So certainly some have claimed, as a result of this, many clerics escaped punishment for serious crimes.
Now, I can imagine that is going to irritate the civil magistrates as well as the population, especially the person who was the victim of the crime of the clergy. And so if a priest stole something or engaged in some kind of sexual transgression against somebody and then went to this through this canonical purgation process and got off scot-free, there would be some conflict here. So I can imagine during this period when common law is developing in the 12th century that this is going to cause some tension between the church and state.
Well, there's a lot of tension, but it's all over jurisdiction. Who has jurisdiction? Now, you have to understand, and this is explained in my essay, that there were many aspects of ordinary daily life over which the church had jurisdiction for everyone in England. Of course, this becomes problematic as it is no longer the case that everyone is of the same religion. But of course, until the Reformation, there is only really one religion, the Catholic religion, but the church has jurisdiction over marriage, everyone's marriage. That's not something that the secular courts have jurisdiction over. There's certainly lots of scholarship on that. Charlie Donahue at Harvard has a massive study of jurisdiction over marriage. Dick Helmholtz has written about it also. Probate, the passing of personal property, was entirely within the jurisdiction of the church. Legally, land could not be left by will in England. This is another long, somewhat complicated story, but legally it could not be left by will until 1540. It all passed by the law of inheritance, but personal property was subject to probate, and the church had jurisdiction over that. And, of course, for everyone, and, of course, they had jurisdiction over what you might call religious offenses, fornication, adultery, blasphemy, those types of things. But the church courts could not award money damages. They could only award penance. Now, some people bought out their penance. They gave money to escape penance, but the church courts could not directly award money damages. For a long time, the church courts had jurisdiction over defamation. The seminal piece on this was written by Dick Helmholtz. You could sue in the local courts, but for defamation, but you could not until the early 16th century sue in the royal courts, in the primary royal courts, for defamation. You could only sue in the church courts, which couldn't award money damages.
Now, there's some other things that go on in daily life that interact with the church as well. So it's not only the citizenry of England at the time, but the church is receiving funding from the monarchy. I assume that the monarchy helps to collect.
Well, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know to what extent that's true.
Okay.
That's not an area within my expertise, but lots of people are paying money to the monarchy, so you'd have to check with someone else, but I am, and certainly the church. Everyone pays taxes and other kinds of things. And certainly there are gifts by the monarchy to the church or to individual men in the church. But I'm not sure you're right there. You'd have to check with someone else that the monarchy is supplying money to the church.
Well, what I'm interested in your paper is the section that you talk about conflict over things such as the patronage, benefices, pensions, as well as other things such as mortuary payments and land and property disputes that seem to intersect between what the monarchy is doing and what the church is doing. If you could explain that a little bit.
Well, certainly initially the church, As I explain in the essay, and sort of the first part of the essay does not involve any original research for me. It's just sort of an overview based on research done by others of the sort of interaction of clergy with the secular courts. I wanted to add, when you talked about a robbery or a murder, the fact that the criminal aspects were subject to the jurisdiction of the church through the notion of benefit of clergy does not mean that the victim couldn't sue in the secular courts against a clergyman who had killed someone or assaulted someone or raped someone or stolen property. They could sue in the secular courts against them no different than suing a secular person who had done those things. But there were certain activities of the clerics that I talk about. This is not something I'm really an expert in, that involved tithing and mortuaries and benefices, and certainly those matters created disputes between church men who had conflicts that, you know, it belonged to them rather than another church person, and conflicts between churchmen on things like tithing and their parishioners who were the ones that tithed. And as the paper shows, and this is not part of my original research, there was a gradual sort of lessening of church court jurisdiction over those things, because the people who sued where they could get the best remedies, and so many of those things started being treated as forms of property, which was subject to the jurisdiction of the secular courts. And while I can't give you all the details, something like tithing ended up subject to the jurisdiction of both courts in a rather complicated way. So in these sort of religious activities, there certainly was a general movement away from church court jurisdiction, even when the plaintiffs were clerics, because like anyone who brings a lawsuit, they went where they could get the best remedy.
Yes, and this is where your argument is going, as I understand it, that the development of this dual legal structure, the clergy were able to manipulate where they wanted to go in terms of canon law or common law. And now what you're studying here, you divide the historical periods that you're looking into two different eras. One is from the late 1200s until the late 1300s, and then from that point until about the 15th century. So what is going on in these periods with respect to the development of common law, and then how the clergy manipulated, or as you say in the title, abused that?
Well, I divided only in the portion of the article that is my original research on abusive litigation or abuse of legal procedure, as it's known, by the clergy. I think one point of the article, and I'll answer your question specifically in a minute, one point of the article is the first part shows, using the research of others, that there was great interaction both as plaintiffs and defendants by clergy members in secular courts. And when it came to misusing the legal system, which is what abuse of legal procedure is, these are what you might say are the modern counterparts of malicious prosecution, abuse of process, the tort of wrongful civil litigation, and a number of other kinds of things. They're just as involved in those things as well as secular people. So the focus of my research is on the involvement of the clergy in this misuse of the legal system. That's what abuse of legal procedure is. Bringing wrongful litigation, doing things that like bribery or other, you know, false testimony and other kinds of things that are unlawful abuses of the litigation process. And the main point of the article is to show how clergy were just as involved in these things as were secular people, as more generally clergy were involved in the secular courts. Now, on the two periods, those two periods are restricted to my original research and my discussion of the involvement of clergy in abuse of legal procedure. And those two periods have nothing to do with the involvement of the clergy. This project, this essay, draws on a much larger project that I'm working on, a book for Cambridge University Press, which is the abuse of legal procedure, the misuse of the legal system, abuse of litigation from roughly 1272 to 1485, and how authorities attempted to deal with people who misused the legal system. And my division into two periods has nothing to do with clergy. It has to do with different, the evolution of different mechanisms by authorities to deal with abuse of misuse of the legal system, perversion of the legal system, and different mechanisms developed from the late 13th century to the end of the 14th century, specifically the civil and criminal offense of conspiracy is a main weapon, and another offense known as champerty, which I can come back and explain to, whereas in the later period, it's the medieval offense of maintenance. So the division of two periods is based on the overall legal response in the mechanisms being developed by the Crown and Parliament and the judges to deal with people who misuse the legal system.
Let's go ahead and discuss how that develops and explain those two terms that you use, champerty. It's not a very common word we use today, and maintenance, and I don't think that has the common usage that we have today as well either.
Well, the title of my book is Maintenance in Medieval England, and it's best to start with that. Maintenance was a word in medieval England that had at least three meanings, only one of which would be familiar to a modern person. It generally meant support. So if you maintained a church or you maintained a child, it just was the ordinary meaning of maintenance, like you would do today, that you were supporting them in one way or another. But maintenance developed two other meanings, what I'll call a social meaning and a legal meaning. It became a term used in a very broad, undefined way in many types of contexts to mean a sort of collection of various types of wrongdoing whereby people were deprived of their legal rights or their ability to gain a legal remedy in court was made more difficult or precluded. And if you would look, and I've written some of this, well, I guess not much of it's published yet, but if you would look outside the sort of legal system to, say, medieval literature, I don't know how much you're familiar with medieval literature, but if you would look at, you won't see it so much in Chaucer, but if you would look in Langland, Pierce, Plowman, the works of John Gower, the York Corpus Christi plays, you would find all kinds of discussions of the evil manipulations of lawyers and the legal system, and the use of the word maintenance to describe these sort of collective forms of this collection of wrongful practices that prevented people from exercising their rights or getting a remedy. You would also see the word maintenance used in that broad, undefined way in petitions to the king and council, that which was a very common practice. People petitioned for the king's exercise of grace rather than suing to deal with a person who's causing them trouble, usually powerful people who are preventing them from exercising their rights. And they would also use the term maintenance. They would complain of maintenance in the sense that what I've called the social meaning of this sort of collection of various types of wrongful conduct, which could involve perjury, maybe sometimes even violence, certainly bribery, extortion, influencing juries. You begin to get statutes that create the legal misdemeanor of maintenance, which means assisting a person in litigation where you are not involved. And it was mainly directed at powerful individuals and officials who were sort of putting their finger on the scale to help some people against others, and that was the legal notion of maintenance, doing things to assist or support a lawsuit in which you were not a party. And so it had a much narrower meaning, and not all forms were illegal. Champerty was a specific type of maintenance, clearly thought to be the worst type, and so you see litigation about it arising sooner in this earlier period than in the later period. Champerty means that in return for helping someone in their litigation, if they recover, you will get all or a part of the subject matter of the litigation, the money or the land. And it means in medieval French, I don't know how much French you know, champ, like Champs-Élysées, field, partie, part of the field. In other words, you get part of the land for helping out. It is a special form of maintenance. So in the early period, the main litigation to deal with people who misuse the legal system is conspiracy, and there's both criminal and civil conspiracy, and champerty. But by far, criminal conspiracy is the most common notion. There's a group of civil conspiracy that is very common, and that's where someone causes a person to be falsely charged with a criminal offense, and they are acquitted. They then sue the person or persons who caused them to be falsely charged by a writ of conspiracy. That's a civil action, and they recover money damages. But as time moves on, and you get into the second period that really starts in 1377, which is the first year of the reign of Richard II, and extends through the end of the medieval period, but that's somewhat of a subject of debate that when the medieval period ends. But certainly 1485, the defeat of Richard III and the becoming king of Henry Tudor, Henry IV, is one terminus point. That when you get into the second period, the main weapon become private lawsuits against individuals for maintenance, because they think someone has helped their adversary in a lawsuit. So that's why it's divided into two periods, and those, I hope that defines well enough and answers your question.
It does, and I'm interested in how the clergy can get involved in this. Now, by what you just described, I can kind of see how the clergy would become involved, especially in Champerty. I mean, if he can get part of the land, why not do that? Give us some examples of how this would play out, clergy abuse. They can either be real examples or just a hypothetical example that's an amalgamation of different cases that may have occurred during this era.
Well, I suppose you could just, let me sort of take a look here more closely. You could just talk in both periods. You take some of the cases I found and use them as an example. So let me do that. So here's a very early one where clerics are charged with conspiracy. And I'll probably have to define something. In the 1293 heir of Kent, clerics, a monk, a chaplain, and a clerk, were among a number of individuals who were indicted as conspirators and maintainers of parties in various courts. I should explain what it means when you talk about an heir. There was a system of itinerant justices that began in the late 12th century and continued on a regular but not necessarily frequent basis to the end of the 13th century, where a large, kind of the whole royal government would visit a particular county and do all the legal business, hear the civil cases, deal with the people who were in jail already, receive indictments, and make a general inquiry into whether local people were trampling on royal rights. It became very unpopular because it was like a roving royal commission from London coming out and, you know, sort of inquiring into everything going on in a local area. But from a legal standpoint, it was important because that's where the judges heard a lot of litigation. And so these were itinerant judges. Heir is the law French word for the Latin word for journey, iter, from which the word itinerant comes. And so there are these heirs. And so they were held periodically in different counties. And so you have this situation where all these religious folks are charged with others for conspiring, and they're all found guilty. Banding together and agreeing to help certain people whenever they were plaintiffs or defendants in lawsuits, by, you know, just sort of showing maybe a show of force, maybe coming to court with them, maybe giving them money, maybe influencing the jury, all kinds of things that they might have done. Another example involved a parson who forcibly abjected a widow from her land at his own cost. And then supported the plaintiff who got her thrown off, and he got the land in return. So those are early examples of both a conspiracy and a maintenance suit that involved clerics for doing things that were no different than secular folks did. Their conduct is generally indistinguishable. Clerics might range from people in a local area who were very influential to people who weren't, just like other local just like other local folks. Now, when you get into the later period, you might have people who just agreed to help them find a lawyer or to testify in a lawsuit, and then they would be they would bring a maintenance suit against them, and they would claim they were justified in doing what they did, and the plaintiffs would say, no, you did a lot more. You bribed the jury. You lied in court. You did all those kinds of things. And so then the jury would have to decide who was telling the truth. So those are some examples of the kind of things that would occur.
Now, with this dual system, you have canon law and you have the common law. Was it quite common that the clergy would get into some mischief, some champerty in the common law courts, and then if somebody came after them, say, whoa, you have to try me in the canon law court, and would they get a more favorable hearing in that canon law court?
Well, in those things, the canon law courts did not have jurisdiction. They couldn't be sued in the canon law court.
Okay. But did I would assume
they
that's...
could only be properly sued in the ecclesiastical court for things over which the ecclesiastical court had jurisdiction.
Okay. But I would imagine that some priest tried to manipulate that to some extent, or was that never the case?
Well, I can't say. I wouldn't say I found a lot of evidence of that.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly are attempts to sue the clerics on more ordinary things involving property or contracts in the secular court, in the church courts, where the clergy object and say, "This, you can't sue me in the church courts because this does not involve a matter over which the church courts have jurisdiction." And other people could say that also. And originally what they would do, as you see from the early part of the article, they would get a writ of prohibition, essentially a writ issued by the king to the ecclesiastical court that they were prohibited from taking jurisdiction of the matter because it did not involve a subject over which the ecclesiastical court had jurisdiction.
As we're nearing the end of our podcast here, two more questions I have to ask. Did all this abuse eventually get cleaned up after the English Reformation? Did this pattern all settle down?
The Reformation had absolutely no influence on any of this, and it's a perennial problem. Lawyers complain about it today. Anytime any society creates a legal system or any system for resolving disputes, there's the potential for people to misuse it. And that goes on today. So this is a perennial problem that, in my view, never gets completely resolved. The Reformation has no impact, is totally irrelevant for any of these kinds of things.
Yeah, the reason I asked that is because I thought, well, once the English Reformation came in, the king could more or less tame the what would become known as the Church of England. But you make a very good point here, is that wherever there are institutions, there always can be abuse of those institutions. And that
and the Reformation doesn't stop the church courts from England in England from functioning.
Right.
They're no longer appeals to Rome, and the king is the head of the English church. But it has little impact on the sort of daily functioning of litigation.
That is interesting to know, because that's something that I would have not expected. But as you mentioned, where there are institutions, there always can be institutional abuse. And that leads me to my final question. This is a very interesting topic, but one that tends to be rather remote to us here in the United States, both in time and space. Is there anything that you learned from your investigations into all of this that might resonate with us today? What lessons can we take from what you're doing to apply to our contemporary
world? Well, I think my answer would be what I just told you.
Right.
That any time you create a system, particularly a formal legal system, which they did in medieval England and which we have today, for resolving disputes, it can be misused. And when it's misused, the legal system has to try to deal with those who will misuse it. It may take different forms at different times, but you certainly have no shortage today of reactions against class actions being abused by lawyers, as well as litigants of people who are engaged in unjustified litigation or engaged in false allegations. One of the most interesting developments today that harkens right back to medieval England is the practice that started in the England and the United States of seeking external funding for litigation. That begins to look somewhat like medieval champerty. And that is something that the courts are just starting to come to grips with now.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what you learn is while the misuse may take different forms and the responses may take different forms, it's a perennial problem that is difficult to deal with. And, of course, it all depends on whose ox is being gored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always been kind of an ambivalent attitude toward litigation. It's wonderful when you're suing to vindicate your own rights, but if someone's suing you, it obviously is wrongful.
Yep, that is a common problem throughout history, and the lessons that you draw from your own research into medieval English common law and the misuse of it are very, very important for us to remember until today. So I want to thank my guest, Jonathan Rose, for being on Research on Religion. Jonathan, thanks for being on the show.
You're welcome. Enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.